Today on the 21st Show, future Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall once gave a speech at the University of Illinois. In fact, it was 70 years ago this past weekend. We'll reflect on what's changed in the decades since and on what hasn't.
Black people are not begging for their freedom. They are demanding what was inherently ours from the beginning.
I'm Brian Mackey with the Fight for Civil Rights, Then and Now, today on the 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WNIJ in Rockford-DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, news. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Thurgood Marshall accomplished a lot for the civil rights movement in his lifetime. As a lawyer, he argued more than 30 cases before the nation's highest court, including Brown against Board of Education, which ultimately ruled that segregation in public schools was unconstitutional. Marshall eventually became a justice on the Supreme Court himself, the first African American to serve. But long before that, 70 years ago this week, March 8, 1956, Marshall visited the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign to talk about his work and the problems of segregation and racism that were still all too common, even in Illinois.
Years ago, as we will remember, the so-called race problem in this country was something that, if it was as large as some people thought it was merely a southern problem. Others try to make it a city problem. Others try to make it a neighborhood problem in one city. But whether you like it or not, or whether I like it or not, or whether any of us like it, the so-called problem of color has become a world problem. And indeed, if anybody had wanted to play it down or to forget about it, that time has long since passed.
So where do we stand 70 years on? What's changed and what hasn't? Today we're going to revisit a conversation we had about this with Minnie Pearson, president of the NAACP in Champaign County, and Eric McDuffie, an associate professor in the Department of History and the Department of African American Studies at the University of Illinois. He's also director of the Center for African Studies there. We first broadcast this conversation back in January 2024 on Martin Luther King Day, so you'll hear a few references to that. And because our program's on tape, we're not taking calls, but we always appreciate hearing from you. You can let us know what you thought by emailing us at talk@21stshow.org. All right, Minnie Pearson, I want to begin with you. I want to come back to Thurgood Marshall's words we heard in the introduction to this conversation. What do you think of that?
Well, if you stop and think about it, and see what I want you to understand too is you're talking to Minnie Pearson from originally from Greenville, Mississippi, where a lot of this was just blatant in your face. It's built into the fabric of this country. It started from the very beginning. The structure of this country was never intended to accommodate people of color. So there is no way that we can get around facing the fact that we're still struggling today to become part of what we have been very instrumental in building from the very beginning.
You know, one of the things Marshall said in that clip was, if anybody wanted to play it down or forget about it, that the time has long since passed. You know, even today we hear, oh, this was our history, or you hear somebody say something like, I don't see color. You know, even if the people are well-intentioned who say that, Ms. Pearson, what effect does that have?
There is absolutely no way that me as a Black person, and I consider myself a Black person, of course we do have people of color, can walk into a room where people do not know me and not see my color. To not see my color is to not see me.
Professor McDuffie, I'd like to bring you into the conversation now. How do Thurgood Marshall's words there resonate with you today, especially this idea that the problem of color, as he put it, is at a worldwide scale?
Yes, great question. That, you know, that's what really caught my attention when Thurgood Marshall, the civil rights luminary, first African-American to sit on the Supreme Court, how he understood racism, race, the African-American freedom struggle in a global context. I think that, for me, is what really stands out. And I think so often when we think about the civil rights movement, or when it's taught, at least from a mainstream perspective, it's so often taught within the domestic confines of the United States. In other words, we fail to understand how Black people, and I certainly agree with what Ms. Pearson was saying, how Black people in this country have really always understood that we were not understood to be a part of this country, or rather this country was not designed for us, or rather for our own well-being. And what Thurgood Marshall was really was getting at is that we need to understand the African-American freedom struggle through or in a global context, that our destiny is inextricably linked to the freedom struggles of all people globally, especially, of course, people of African descent and other people of color. So that's, for me, was the key takeaway from that clip.
Let's listen to a little more of Thurgood Marshall's speech from 1956 at the University of Illinois. Professor McDuffie, I'm going to ask you to respond to this first.
I say today, if we're going to face this problem of race relations as it applies in this country, we must get rid of all of our old theories of the Negro begging for, weeping for, and the other side generously giving from the bounty of their heart rights that are guaranteed by the Constitution to all of us.
So, Eric McDuffie, how did the civil rights movement mark a change in the attitudes among the people who were fighting for those rights?
Yeah, it's a great question. Again, it's a very powerful clip from Thurgood Marshall, where he's arguing that, you know, Black people aren't begging or asking for civil rights, but are in fact demanding civil rights. What I would caution us, or really encourage us to understand, is that we also need to understand that the African-American freedom struggle was and is more than a struggle simply for civil rights. That so often, again, the understanding of the movement is based around voting rights and housing desegregation. And certainly I'm not trying to de-emphasize the importance of voting rights or desegregation, but a larger struggle for human rights. And again, what Marshall, I think, was getting at is that, again, that Black people are not begging for their freedom. They are demanding what was inherently ours from the beginning.
Minnie Pearson, I wonder if you want to respond to that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I totally agree. They were not begging, and we are not begging even today. We are demanding. We are demanding, and we will not settle for anything less. We are the only race of people who were brought here against our will. We were brought here in chains for the sole purpose to build up this country. So we're not going to beg for anything that is owed to us. And that's why it is important that we were ready to face any challenges, any shape, form, or fashion, economics or whatever, to get our point across, to let people know enough is enough. We want to be treated humanly, humanity. We demanded respect. We demanded to be acknowledged for the work that we had done for free for so many years. And now we want reparation.
You know, when we think of Martin Luther King today, he's a secular saint, right? There's a huge marble statue in Washington, D.C. But he was, in our modern language, he was polarizing at the time. Minnie Pearson, there was a divide, especially between Black Americans and white Americans and how they perceived him and the civil rights movement, right? Polls in the 1960s found that more white Americans thought Dr. King was hurting the cause of civil rights than helping it. I wonder how you've seen those sort of attitudes come up in your own life and work.
Of course, he had a strategy. He had a strategy just as other people had something opposite. But the common goal was to achieve without having us being judged at the same time as people who were barbaric. We followed our leader, Martin Luther King, and his strategy worked for us. We tackled by letting people know exactly economically what we wanted and how we were needed when we boycotted the buses and not riding the buses, how that hurt white America. Everybody is entitled to their opinion, but he had a strategy and we followed that. And it worked for us. And it's working today. We will not settle. We will not settle. We will let you know right away that, yes, there were our ancestors fought, bled, and died for to be free and to get what is owed to them. We do not, under any circumstances, want you to look at a structure, the same structure, and move furniture around and change things around and try to make this a little better, that a little better, and then think that we're going to be satisfied with that. We want the treatment of humanity. We want civil rights. We want educational opportunities, fair representation. We want criminal justice reform. We want voting. We want all of the rights of any other race of people who have come here on their own and made it. And we're still struggling. No, this is not going to wash anymore. We demand to be treated humanly, and we have earned. And don't tell us that we can't do, because look at what we've done. We built this country. This country would not be what it is today without the backs of Black people. So this is what it is strongly stated. And this is why we are persistent and consistent. We are fighting, and we will continue to do that.
Professor McDuffie, I want to stick with this idea of King's unpopularity in his time versus how he's viewed today, and think, is there a through line with that in the way, you know, in certain quarters, the Black Lives Matter movement, for example, is something to be distrusted? Same story, different day?
What I would say is this, and this is what I say in the classroom to my students, that Dr. King today has been sanitized, simplified, and commodified.
I agree.
Thank you, Sister Pearson. It's critical for us to understand that Dr. King was a radical. Uh-huh. And of course, that term radical, its root word is root. That means to get to the problem, right? Uh-huh. And that today, what happens with Dr. King or the civil rights, Black Power movement, the Black Freedom movement, the narrative gets simplified. It gets turned into a story about Black people basically fighting for only voting rights or the right to eat a hamburger, as Ella Baker, the civil rights genius grassroots activist, argued. It also gets the narrative of the civil rights Black Power movement gets transformed into a story about famous Black men. So focus on Dr. King or Brother Malcolm, but not talking about people like Ella J. Baker or Fannie Lou Hamer. But to your question about Dr. King, and I think this is why Dr. King's message and his legacy are more important than ever. You know, in 1957, he went to Ghana. He attended the independence ceremony in Ghana, March 6th, 1957, the Ghanaian Independence Day. And he was crying like a baby when that British Union Jack went down and the Ghanaian flag went up and Kwame Nkrumah, the founder of Ghana, announced the freedom of Ghana. And Dr. King said that he felt like he was witnessing the end, the death of colonialism and the emergence of a new world. You fast forward that to the mid-60s, to the late 60s, a year or two before he passed away, when he was outspoken against what he called the triple evils of poverty, racism, and war. When he became an outspoken opponent against the Vietnam War. Certainly, he was not the first Black person to speak out against the Vietnam War. Actually, he came to it fairly late, in contrast to, say, Brother Malcolm or folks in SNCC. But the point I'm getting at is that the way Dr. King understood the connections between racism, U.S. foreign policy, empire, and poverty. Indeed, in fact, he said, he often said privately capitalism. And that what he was arguing is that this country needed, as he called it, a revolution of values, where humanity was more important than profit lines or computers, what have you. And so to your question about Black Lives Matter, or to your question about how Dr. King is remember today, again, isn't this country still at war? Aren't Black folks still second-class citizens? Doesn't this country lock up more people than any other country in the planet, including all those countries that this country says are evil and awful, like China, Iran, North Korea? And of course, half those folks in prison are Black. So Dr. King was really getting to the foundations of what this country has always been about. And again, to echo it, Sister Pearson was talking about, right, that people of African descent, at least prior to 1865, we were brought here to work. We were brought here to build the capital that made this country and the rest of the Western world rich and wealthy. And until this country comes to terms with this past, which in fact isn't in the past, Black folk will continue to be second class citizens, but this country will continue to be stuck and mired in not only its racist past, but its racist present.
Okay, we need to take a break. Let me reintroduce our conversation. My guests are Eric McDuffie, professor at the University of Illinois, and Minnie Pearson, head of the NAACP in Champaign County. I originally spoke with them back on Martin Luther King Day 2024. This conversation is tied to a speech that Thurgood Marshall, a future Supreme Court justice at the time, gave at the U of I back in 1956. It was 70 years ago this week. No calls today, but you can let us know what you think by emailing talk@21stshow.org. We'll continue after a short break. This is The 21st Show. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Let's get back to our conversation on the legacy of the civil rights movement. It's structured around a speech that Thurgood Marshall delivered at the University of Illinois 70 years ago this week, 1956. Of course, later in life, he'd become a Supreme Court justice. At the point he gave this speech, however, he had just a few years prior argued before the court in the landmark case Brown against Board of Education. Joining us for the conversation about this was Eric McDuffie, an associate professor in the Department of African American Studies and the Department of History at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Also, Minnie Pearson, president of the NAACP in Champaign County. I should mention we first broadcast this on Martin Luther King Day in January 2024. You will hear some references to that as we go along. That said, because our program's on tape, no calls, but let us know what you thought. Our email address, talk@21stshow.org. Ms. Pearson, I know you wanted to respond to some of the things that Professor McDuffie had said before we took a break about, you know, relating the struggles of the past to current movements trying to secure equality, civil rights, freedom, and so on.
And I totally agree with Professor. But the one thing I want to stress is one of the things I felt as a teacher in Unit 4 school for 32 years, teaching my students Black history and excerpts as much as I possibly could, I think Martin Luther King wanted to turn the mirror around instead of showing violence, which would hurt us as a race, would hurt us and show us as barbaric and fighters and turn us on ourselves, basically, and we would lose our message that we were trying to convey and get across. He wanted to turn that around and show who the violent people were. We did nonviolent. They hit with bricks, water, dogs, all kinds of things to stop us from trying to get the rights that we so rightly deserved. So he turned it around and he let the young black people know that, look, the way to get what we want is not through violence. It is to show them, people who do not look like us, who are fighting against giving us what we rightfully deserve. Look at how they behave. We want to do just the opposite. We want to be strategic about this. We want to show America what we have been enduring for hundreds of years. And so this was one of the reasons why, when we say Black Lives Matter, yes, Black Lives do matter, because at all times, Black people were being killed by people who did not look like them, where we know that it was very rare that Black people were killing white people or people who do not look like them. But all lives matter, but the emphasis was on who is dying now? Who is being killed through the healthcare system, through the education system? Who's being denied the rights to a quality of life? Who's being denied all of the rights and privileges that any human being should have? He turned it around, said, look in the mirror and see how this is happening.
Let's return to the tape of Thurgood Marshall's speech at the University of Illinois in 1956. It was 2 years after the case of Brown versus Board of Education, which he argued and won, had been decided, but he still had plenty to say on it because, as we still know today, that was not anywhere near the end of the story.
I would be unfair if I stood in the state of Illinois and didn't say that southern states like Missouri and West Virginia made more progress than has been made in southern Illinois in getting rid of segregated schools.
So, Ms. Pearson, so much of the history of civil rights focuses on what happened in southern states, but there were battles being fought in Illinois. What are the parallels to be drawn between then and now in terms of school segregation? And I know you can speak specifically to the Champaign School District, just in the last few years, tried to change a policy called Schools of Choice in an attempt to better desegregate the schools.
We can put laws into place. We can put people into buildings. We can put us together. But if you don't change hearts and beliefs, you will not get anywhere. You have to change the hearts and the mindset of the people who is teaching our children, who is responsible every day for making our children feel wanted, high expectations, accountability, knowing their history, knowing their worth, and feeling like they belong. If they feel like they do not belong, if they don't feel wanted, children cannot articulate oftentimes what they're feeling, but they can act it out. So what you're seeing in a lot of different places is children acting out, not feeling wanted. We can have teachers who do not look like them, who don't understand them culturally, and will teach like you teach a child who had all rights and privileges all their lives. And so when we react to that, and when things don't happen the way the powers to be expect, for instance, hairstyles, our talk, our walk, the way we act, we are culturally expressing ourselves, but it's looked at as if it's threatening to some certain people.
Professor McDuffie, you mentioned a little earlier in our conversation about the sanitization of Dr. King and the civil rights movement, the focus on the men. There was a woman that Thurgood Marshall spoke about, and that was Authoring Lucy. Can you just briefly, we have another clip to play, but can you briefly set us up for listeners who may not be familiar? Why was she in the national spotlight in 1956?
I can, Brian, but is it cool if I say just a few words about that?
Sure,
previous
sure.
Clip?
Yeah.
Sure, absolutely. I'll keep it short. You know, one of the things that caught my attention about Thurgood Marshall and speaking at the U of I is that in the 1950s, Black students were were banned from living in dormitories on campus.
Yes.
I forgot the exact year when Black students were allowed to live on campus, but for decades, Black students, they lived in sorority and fraternity houses, and they lived among local Black Champaign-Urbana residents. So I think it's important that we not overlook, dare I say, the racist heritage of the U of I and the exclusion of Black students at the U of I until really the late 60s and early 70s through Project 500. And of course, as Sister Pearson knows, as we all know, that this is an ongoing struggle. And two, and maybe we'll come back to this a bit later, I think it's also important that we not sanitize the history, the very violent racist history of the state of Illinois and of the Midwest. We can't forget that Illinois, like Ohio and other Midwestern states, passed what were called Black laws in the early 19th century that barred Blacks from coming into the state or from holding jobs or from sitting on juries. And of course, the extreme violence, racial violence, racist pogroms that Black people experienced here in Illinois from the so-called Springfield riot of 1908, which of course would lead to the response would lead to the formation of the NAACP when Black folk like W.E.B. Du Bois or Ida B. Wells were horrified by the kind of violence that Black folks experienced in Illinois. Of course, the East St. Louis riot of 1917, Chicago so-called riot of 1919, the post-war violence in Chicago where white mobs, and of course this happened prior to, or after the First World War, where white mobs were going into now what are now all Black neighborhoods like Englewood, but then we're all white and attacking Black people who try to move into those neighborhoods. So again, I think it's critically important for us not to think about the struggle for civil rights or human rights as simply a Southern problem or a problem that was unique to the Southern states of this country, but was indeed a national problem and indeed a global one. To your question about authoring Lucy, first African-American woman to desegregate to attend the University of Alabama. Very, very interesting story and very brave and courageous woman. Again, speaks her life speaks and legacy speaks to the centrality of Black women, African-American women to the African-American freedom struggle. To make a very long story short, she enrolled at the University of Alabama. The school resisted threw her out in 1956. Thurgood Marshall, the NAACP, mounted a very noble legal case to support her, but ultimately she was expelled. She did actually receive an honorary degree decades later from the University of Alabama. But her story has been largely forgotten, in part because it's bookended between the 1954 Brown v. Board of Education Supreme Court decision and Little Rock of 1957. But again, a courageous, pioneering African-American woman who attempted to, or who was the first Black person to desegregate the University of Alabama.
All right, let's listen to another clip from Thurgood Marshall's speech, 1956, at the University of Illinois. This is in response to arguments that came up against authoring Lucy and, in the years ahead, many other Black students.
Anybody has a right to say, I will not go to college with a Negro. But nobody has a right to say that that Negro can't go to my college. If you don't want to go to college with Negroes, get out. And if you find that the next college you go to has Negroes, get out of that one. You still have maintained your right, and I'll protect your right. You go from college to college, you end up, there are no colleges where there aren't Negroes. You still have your constitutional right to stay away from college and die a dummy. You still keep your right, and I'll protect your right.
Your right to die a dummy. Professor McDuffie, what do you think of what he had to say there, especially in the context of in the past year, we see, you know, continued attacks on affirmative action, diversity in education?
Thurgood Marshall was spot on. And it's amazing how so many white folk then and now will fight tooth and nail to be stupid, tooth and nail to resist learning and thinking critically about this country's past and present and future. Their resistance to learning about the centrality of African descended people to the making of humanity. Again, he was spot on.
And I totally agree. Totally agree. On a personal level, starting to teach in Unit 4 schools in the early, late 70s, when I got into the door, I was asked to come to a specific school here in Champaign. And on the first day of school, everybody was gathered. I'm there. I'm the only Black teacher there. I'm not the only Black teacher that has been in the building, but at the particular time, I was the only one that's there. And one of the so-called teachers came up to me, and I thought, oh, she's smiling. She's friendly, and I'm going to be received. And she says, oh, I is glad to meet you. You are one of the affirmative action hires. And so I didn't know anything about I was an affirmative action hire. I knew that I was totally qualified, attending the University of Illinois, going through all of the hoops and knocking down barrels and things that I needed to do in order to graduate with my undergrad degree. And so I felt pretty good about where I was. But on every third or fourth day, it was mentioned that you got here because of affirmative action. Well, no one ever said anything about a lot of them got through college because of a legacy of things that has happened to them, white privileges. And so I agree, this thing of pointing to us why we should not be somewhere or somehow or another is going to dilute an education. Black people have always been hungry for education. Look at the many things that they did to learn to read, to write, to think, to be critical thinkers. Their lives were on the line, but it didn't stop them. Education is very important. And I agree that the Black community took in a lot of the Black students who came to the University of Illinois with no place to stay, the churches up and down Park and Fifth Street, other churches and houses here in Champaign-Urbana took in these young students and fed them and clothed them and housed them and educated them and made them feel safe. So
That's right.
A lot of and then when they finally had no choice, the University of Illinois decided, well, we will put them far away, FAR, way out on the campus someplace, away where we won't have to look at them. So there were all kinds of things going on that we helped each other, we supported each other, and a lot of them would not have made it had it not been for the Black community.
FAR, for people who are not from Champaign-Urbana, did not attend the University of Illinois, stands for Florida Avenue Residence Halls, but it is at the very far south end of the campus. It's basically FAR and then the veterinary school and cornfields after that. Interesting reference. Professor McDuffie, we have to take a break in about 2 minutes here, but I wonder if you wanted to add anything to that.
Oh, you know, she said it. Sister Pearson said it. So please, I'm good.
All right. I want to cue up the next part of our conversation. We're going to listen to a little more tape from Thurgood Marshall. We'll need to take a break, and then we can come back and talk more about it. But one of the things that was on his mind, and because his speech at the U of I came not long after Emmett Till was lynched, brutally murdered in Mississippi. The men accused of his murder were found not guilty by an all-white jury. They later admitted they murdered him, and even then, people still tried to shift the responsibility of the murder away from him. Marshall talked about that. Let's listen to what he had to say.
They even said that the NAACP arranged for the murder so we'd have something to talk about. Well, if the only way we could get attention to this problem would be to murder somebody in Mississippi, with all of the available ones down there, it wouldn't be a poor little 14-year-old boy from Chicago. They also said that he shouldn't have been killed, but he should have been punished. They've tried every way possible to explain away the guilt, not of the two men involved. I'm not worried about them, not at all. They try to explain away the guilt of the good people that allowed men like that to go free.
Okay, we're going to think about what he said as we take another break here. When we come back, we'll hear more from Eric McDuffie, who's associate professor in the Departments of African American Studies and in the Department of History at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Also, Minnie Pearson, president of the NAACP of Champaign County. We're listening back to a speech from civil rights leader Thurgood Marshall before he became a Supreme Court justice. He visited the U of I back in March 1956, 70 years ago this week, and gave a speech that remains strikingly relevant today. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Today, for the hour, we're marking 70 years since Thurgood Marshall, civil rights leader, future Supreme Court justice, visited the University of Illinois to deliver a speech on race and racism. We're listening back to parts of that speech and talking about it with Minnie Pearson, president of the NAACP in Champaign County, and Eric McDuffie, associate professor in the Departments of African American Studies and History at the University of Illinois. We first broadcast this conversation on MLK Day 2024. With that in mind, no calls today, but you can let us know what you thought. Our email address is talk@21stshow.org. All right, before the break, we heard Marshall talking about the case of Emmett Till, which was still very much fresh in the minds of a lot of people. He was not alone. Let's listen to another part of Marshall's speech.
Maybe it takes an Emmett Till's murder to rock some of us on our feet. But for every time that that type of thing happens, there are hundreds and thousands of other instances that sort of run by people's minds. And even then, as in every one of these cases, all the way back as far as we go in history, there is an effort made to wash bloods off of hands.
So, Professor McDuffie, for every Eric Garner, for every George Floyd, there are many more stories, some just as horrific, that get glossed over. And we heard Mr. Marshall making this point 70 years ago. Has much changed with that?
Well, in some ways things have changed, in some ways things have not. And I would say, the absolutely tragic lynching of Emmett Till, but we continue to see, as they were once called, legal lynchings. We see those still taking place today, affecting the killing of Black children, and not just Black, young Black boys. The high-profile case of Tamir Rice, or the in Cleveland, or Laquan McDonald, the teenager in Chicago, but young Black women like Rakia Boyd of Chicago, or the young, I believe she was 9 years old, Ayanna Stanley Jones. That so often the ways that we forget about how Black girls are often victimized by state violence, be it the police or extralegal violence. But no, I think sadly and tragic, these events are still happening. And what's even more troubling is since Black Lives Matter, or since the summer of 2020, there's actually been an increase in the number of Black people shot and killed by the police. And I'll go there. I'm also very concerned just about the local situation here in Champaign-Urbana, where, for example, the U of I police are expanding their patrols into Champaign, as well as conversations in Urbana to hire 15 more police officers. The way in which policing and incarceration are understood as ways in solving social problems. And again, targeting Black people, especially working class, underemployed, highly vulnerable Black people, Black youth in particular. So unfortunately, these issues are still very persistent, but of course the way in which Black folks have fought back, when we talk about Emmett Till, then we also need, of course, to talk about his mother, Mamie Till Mobley, who after the tragic killing of her son, really made it her life's business, her life's work, to demand the justice for her son. So yes, I'll stop there.
And I will pick up on that. Emmett Till, his mother, really played a very important role. Through her grief and all of the things that she went through, she was adamant that she was going to let the world see her son in the casket looking the way she found him after he was so brutally beaten. It would not have been as publicized if she had not insisted. No, no, no. You're not going to close that casket. We are going to let the world see what these people did to my son and That's so right. many other people. So with that open casket, with him looking unrecognizable and non-human-like, turned it and showed America what had been done, and people have gotten away with it. Me, as a girl growing up in Mississippi, on my way, my brother and I riding with my mother and father to my grandmother's house, a little town called Rosedale. And I remember seeing things hanging from trees, some missing arms, legs, and heads and body parts. And I, not knowing at the age of 5 or 6 what that could have been, I thought, my goodness, someone has left their Halloween decorations out and didn't take them in. I did not know that there were real bodies hanging from trees and nearly most of all around church buildings or around church parking lots and places. People have been treated this way and left to hang there to create fear in other people that if you get out of line, these things can also happen to you. Now, these are things that I've seen with my own eyes, and this is something that no child should have been able to see. I saw those things, and it's been going on, and even today, under the cover of darkness, people get really fearful when they are stopped by the police. Not that all police are bad. Not that that's happened, but it's the connotation, I mean, the things that have been happening to our children. And most of the times it's daylight, and they get away with it because the court system favors them.
If you're just joining us, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're reflecting on progress in civil rights from the 1950s through today, based around a speech that Thurgood Marshall gave at the University of Illinois 70 years ago this week. I do want to mention briefly, as we're getting into this next part of the conversation, you're going to hear one of our guests use a strong racial epithet in describing an early experience she had with racism in Champaign. It's in about 3 minutes. With that in mind, back to the conversation. We've been talking a lot today about stories of the South and the way racism harmed African-Americans there. But as we did talk about a little earlier, racism, segregation, it wasn't just a Southern phenomenon. And Thurgood Marshall did have something to say about that.
Let's shed some tears for Cairo, Illinois, where segregation is so rampant, it's almost unbelievable. And where in areas of Southern Illinois, today, Negroes go down into Kentucky when they get a week off because they feel safer in Kentucky than they do in Illinois.
You know, Professor McDuffie, I've often said that Cairo is closer to Mississippi in Chicago in more ways than one. Can you talk about Southern Illinois from this standpoint?
Oh, sure. You know, Southern Illinois was a citadel of racial violence. There was a Cairo, Illinois site of a horrific race riot, or really a lynching at the turn of the 20th century. And again, especially like the southern half of the state, in some ways much more southern than northern, but at the same time, we don't want to fall into the trap of thinking of Illinois as this kind of racial utopia. Of course, there was a horrific lynching in Danville. We've already mentioned this, the Springfield riot of 1908, the East St. Louis riot of 1917, Chicago riot of 1919. And again, those terms riots are really deceptive. They were really armed mobs of white people going into black neighborhoods and killing and raping and burning and pillaging. every black person in sight. So yes, certainly this southern portion of the state has a very racist history, but so does the entire state.
And I agree with that as well. Real quickly, when I left Mississippi after I graduated May 27th and May 28th, I was on a bus to Champaign, Illinois, and it was told to me by an older black person on the bus with my brother and I, leaving home for the very first time, when we get in Cairo, you do not get off the bus. Don't get off the bus in Cairo. And we did not understand. And so we kept asking her and asking her. She says, didn't you all bring sandwiches? Didn't you all bring something to drink? And these guys, do not get off in Cairo. And once I got to Champaign, I asked about it. And I heard the story of it being overly a sundown town or a town who you would not feel welcome at all. In fact, I want to further expound on when I got to Champaign, I figured as a young high school graduate, I'm coming to the North. I'm free. I'm going to be able to do the things that I didn't and couldn't do in Mississippi. Well, the first time I was called a nigger was when I got to Champaign, Illinois, on Neal Street at a famous cafe, which I will not mention at this time. I went in and I smelled a hamburger being fried and things, and I asked, I said, oh my goodness, that smells just like my mother's a hamburger on a Saturday when we would have hamburgers and hot dogs. And I went in, and I'm thinking, I'm in Illinois. I'm free. I can do what I want to do. I can go where I want to go. I went in and asked the men. I noticed that there were no other black people there, but look where I am. I'm in Champaign. I said to him, oh, hello there. How are you doing? I said, could I please have a hamburger well done, hold the pickles, do this, do that, and then could I have a knee-high grape drink with that? And he looked at me and he smiled, and I figured, oh, yeah. And so, and I said, oh, put the pickles on the side. Don't put them on. He says, is that all you want? And I said, yes. He says, if you don't get your N-word behind out of here. And at first I froze because I just could not believe. It was like I was swimming underwater. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. And to make sure that he knew that I knew that he was serious, he stumped his foot and says, get your blank out of here. And I remember leaving there, running down to a street, not knowing where I was going. And I found myself at a phone booth on First Street calling my daddy to tell him what happened. And that's when he said, you need to seek out the help of the Urban League or the NAACP. Helped me through a lot of the things that I had to face. Once I got to what I said was the North, I was free. So, yes, it was everywhere.
And here you are today, president of the NAACP in Champaign County.
Yes.
Professor McDuffie, we're coming to the end of our time together. What needs to happen to make the next 70 years different than the 70 that have just passed?
That's a great question. And thank you, Sister Pearson, for sharing what you just said. Incredibly powerful. I think first and foremost, you know, I am a historian. I think it's important. It's critically important for us to understand history and to understand that history is uncomfortable. And the only way to move forward is to deal with the discomfort of history. I would also say, just wearing my hat as the acting director for the Center for African Studies, I think it's critical for us to understand, again, going back to what Thurgood Marshall was saying earlier, that we understand the African-American freedom struggle in a global context. So I will go there. I think it's important for us to think critically about the war in Gaza. I think it's important to understand the way in which the U.S. Is very much implicated in what South Africa is calling genocide. I think it's important for us to understand how forces, what might seem far away, those forces are very much in play with affecting us here. For example, the struggles around Gaza or the silencing around Gaza, how that's been used to silence or to wage war against DEI, affirmative action, critical race theory, African-American studies. And so what we're seeing, both a war on people and a war on ideas, is a way to, again, to keep Black folk and folks and freedom-loving people in check. So again, knowing history, knowing that history is uncomfortable, and being aware of the links between the global and the local, I think are essential. Thank you.
Professor Eric McDuffie and Minnie Pearson, president of the NAACP in Champaign County, thank you both so much for being with us to share your knowledge and your personal experiences with us today on the 21st Show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Again, we originally spoke about this in January 2024. Before we go, I want to suggest joining our texting group. We often share comments and questions that you send onto the show. You can join by sending the word TALK to 217-803-0730. Again, just text the word TALK, T-A-L-K, to 217-803-0730. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Kulsum Khan. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.